This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey. Hello.
We have a great show for you this week. In that iconic look, we're going to be looking at the Great Gold Worm. In one unique thing, we'll be looking at how 13th Age handles range and movement in combat. And in Class Act, we'll be looking at the Paladin. Let's head into that iconic look.
That iconic look.
Welcome to that iconic look. We're on page 20 of the core rulebook. Mark, introduce us to the Great Gold Worm.
The Great Gold Worm, GGW for short. He likes to go by GG.
He goes, yeah.
He's a force for good. He's inspirational, kind of like Bahamut from other systems.
Other D&D worlds.
Yes, other D&D worlds. He's unique in that he's stationary because he is plugged a hole to the abyss, keeping the demons from the world. And that's, if you follow that icon, kind of your job, if you're a paladin, which we'll talk about later.
Oh, yeah?
Or others. And he has some enemies.
Well, considering that he would be aligned with the lawful side of things, then the opposite side, the chaotic alignment, were going to be his opponents, specifically the Three and the Diabolist. He has an interesting relationship with the Three because he has worked with them in the past, specifically Red, as Red has also fought off the demons of the Abyss. So that would be a fun relationship to play up as a character.
I also find it interesting that the Paladin, you have the, when we get into the class, you have kind of the good Paladin and the anti-Paladin choices. Both of the, what I would say, the archetypical icons for the Paladin to follow, the Great Gold Worm and the Crusader, both hate demons. Like they both, the one thing they can agree upon is demons bad.
Mm.
I think we could all agree.
Yes.
So the true danger for the Great Gold Worm is that everything will be all right unless he finally loses his battle and the Abyss opens up to swallow the world. And I actually, just because of the nature of how I DM, I also think that it could also be okay unless he gets corrupted by the demons that he is trying to keep in. Mark, would you use something like that? Would you have him fall or be turned if you were running a game with the Great Gold Worm as the focus?
Well, speaking as a GM, it'd probably be more fun to have him turn. Versus just being defeated and gone, now you can use him against the players or become another different kind of icon.
Uh-huh.
The Lich King wasn't always a Lich King, was he?
That's right. He used to be the Wizard King. That's a good point.
If you were George R.R. Martin, you would turn him and then fell him.
Oh, that's true. That's right. He would you would just kill him off as quickly as possible.
After he had some scenes with the Three.
I was totally fine until that last comment.
He brought up Martin.
That's right.
Yeah.
How would you guys change this? We've talked about how icons, while they may be put into one category, they can often be twisted and moved into another category. How would you make the Great Gold Worm, this shining example of goodness, into an ambiguous or even a negative icon?
I think the easiest way would be to change what his motivations are. It seems on the surface that it's very altruistic, that he's trying to save the world by plugging up this hole, fighting off the demons. If you wanted to change it around a little bit, maybe he's trying to, in his forays into the Abyss, wipe them out enough that he could then take over and rule that side of it.
That is one way. His ulterior motives. Another one could be he is, you know, this force for good, and he's been doing it for a long time, and maybe people just don't care. Maybe he's doing such a good job, they don't believe in demons. And he's like, why should I do it anymore?
Oh.
And changes his whole outlook.
Awesome. I want to play in those games, so let's make those happen.
After all, he is a dragon.
That is true. Even a good dragon is still a dragon. That's right. Let's head into one unique thing.
One unique thing.
Welcome to One Unique Thing. Despite 13th Age's D20 roots, it has some very modern, more indie game feel mechanics. For example, there are no need to track squares or movement values or even necessarily have a map. when you're playing 13th Age. Position is a very simple, flexible, and more narrative feel to it. What we have instead of movement values and squares and distances, we have states that characters and monsters can be in. One is based off range, and one is based on the relationship to other combatants. Mark, why don't you tell us about range?
Well, there's three kinds of ranges. There's nearby, far away, and behind. Okay. So if you're nearby, it's a simple move to get to and engage that enemy or that character. You know, more, I can move four squares and do something. So pretty much if you're on the table and you're all moving around, everyone's within sword strike.
Because you still do have a move action as part of your overall turn in 13th Age.
Yes. And then you have far away. And that takes two moves to get far away from a target. And that might be for more rangers or wizards type spellcasters that want to get away from the, you know,
the
tide of
troll.
Mooks who are, or the murderous troll who, we won't go there.
Well, and far away is going to be up to the GM's discretion depending on the situation. If you're playing in a cave somewhere, there may not be enough room to be far away. So
don't give JM ideas. Far away is far away. It's in the book.
Well, in the book, it talks about if you want to go far away, talk to your GM about it and
yes,
whether or not he'll allow that.
Oh,
yes.
Then I'm just going to say everybody cross that out in your books.
Yes. And then we have behind. So that's where intercepts come in. If the person in front of you can intercept an enemy that moves towards you, so that if you get behind, so that can help on your positioning. And that's where it does the narrative part. You have to kind of explain where everyone is. We still use some minis just on the table to kind of show, one, how many enemies you're not kind of track. Do we kill all of them?
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, so you know who's there, who's a mook, who's not, what are they doing? Kind of get an idea of who's engaged and who's not type thing. But, yeah, we don't have to really count the squares, do all that. And we just kind of move, you know, about a foot away. Okay, he's far away, you know, if it's allowable. So far it has been.
Yeah. Until Nick gave me this idea.
Which I will say, some players don't like that. The not having the hexes or not having the squares, not knowing am I 5 feet away or am I 10 feet away. I know some players like that crunch. It definitely is an adjustment playing in this.
Very true.
This newer way of doing it, where okay, so you're close enough that you can move and attack. It doesn't matter that you're 5 feet too far away that you can't actually make it there. So I feel as a player, it's a whole lot more freeing. But I know that there are other players out there who really like that crunchy mechanic there.
Well, and I think going back, I cut my teeth on the Palladium system. So we didn't use like this specific system, but basically this is how we played at the table because.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I learned, minis were collected just to sit on a shelf. You didn't even have them on a board for anything. It was all narrative in your head and a lot of arguments. No, I wasn't there. Yes, you were. And then I think it's where 3-5 came up, and they had the codified so many squares. Here's the map.
Mm-hmm.
It's all laid out. And it's nice. I mean, I have a grid laid out table, and I like props and stuff laid out so people can see what they can do. But it's also fine. I have no problem doing this as far as, yeah, I'm here, I'm nearby, or I'm far away. And as long as you kind of have an idea, that's really more, for me, more of it's just easier to tell a story if you have some sort of props out there to show people what's there.
Good point. All right, Nick, why don't you tell us about how characters can interact and what the relationship component of movement is?
Well, speaking of miniatures, I think that it would definitely be helpful in playing a combat situation using the 13th Age to have miniatures in mm-hmm. there, just for this relationship with the opponents. Just, you know, for this one piece alone, it'd be very helpful. There are three different relationships you can have with your enemy. One of them is free. Where you can have the freedom to just roam about and do whatever you need to, engage with multiple opponents, move far away if you mm-hmm. can. The second one is engaged, and that's where you actually enter into melee combat with your opponent. And then the third state is an action of disengaging, where you were engaged and now you're trying to disengage. And where having miniatures is helpful is the book talks about basing your miniatures, mm-hmm. where if their bases are touching, then it's a very visual way of determining, yes, I'm engaged, or no, I'm not engaged.
Well, we had that in our Wednesday group. It was very clear to see, okay, yes, the barbarian is engaged with this person, but he would have to disengage to go attack this other person.
And now I know why you want to play a halfling barbarian, because they can pop free.
Yeah.
Much easier than the rest of
that's
us.
That's right.
Well, I thought about a never mind.
Well, that's actually a good point, because we're going to talk about how disengaging works. It's a very simple mechanic. You make a normal save, so 11 or higher. If you make it, you're free. If you don't make it, you still get to take your turn or your standard action. You just don't get to move away. You can still move away, but it would provoke an attack of opportunity. The thing to remember for all of you GMs listening is that players suffer a minus one to this roll, the save that they have to make, for every person or every enemy over one that they're engaged with. So if four goblins attack the rogue's got to make their disengage check at minus three. So how do you find this working for you, both as a GM and a player? Do you like it? Do you like the more narrative freeform movement? Are you one of those players that you mentioned, Nick, where you're like, no, I want to know to the centimeter or the inch, if we're playing on squares, how far I can move?
Centimeter for playing in Europe.
That's right.
Personally, I really like the way that this is designed. Like I mentioned before, I like the story side of things. I love combat, don't get me wrong, but I don't like being confined in what I can do and what I can't do. So having these states and these relationships, I feel, gives me a lot of freedom to say, this is what I want my character to do. Okay, I can't, you know, if I were to crunch the numbers, I may not be able to move these, you know, eight spaces away to go do this or go intercept on this other player's behalf. But hey, I'm nearby. I'm definitely going to step up and help my other players out.
I think it just speeds everything up.
Yeah.
Especially there are certain players who will analyze till tomorrow morning. Well, I can move here. That's three squares, or I can move five squares and still do. We're all nearby. You can do what you need to do.
That's right.
And it cuts down on the mechanic and timing of counting out, oh, wait, no, you move seven, you can only move six, you got to move back. Oh, wait, no, you're a dwarf, you can only move 20. You know, you can't move forward, you know, whatever the mechanic is for your game. This, I think, speeds it up. Everyone's the same. If you're nearby, go for it. And it just, everything goes a lot quicker, I've noticed.
I was playing one game where one of the other players was playing a rogue, which is allowed to disengage as a quick action. So they would have a move, you know, able to. So basically what she was doing is she would move into engagement, do her attack, and then do a quick move to disengage. And it drove the GM crazy. He was like, you can't do that. Oh, wait, yes, you can. And
the
she
GM
loved
being me.
It.
Yes.
No, actually, it wasn't you. It was Sal.
Oh, we didn't see him on Wednesday.
That was when you were doing, you know, when he was doing those one shots while you were gone.
Oh, I didn't realize you did a 13th age one.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
No, Stephanie did that on Wednesday night too.
She yeah, was
popping
I
in and
knew
out.
Knew that's how that worked.
Yes. He didn't complain about it. He just kind of gritted his teeth and like, yes,
that's
pop
right.
out for free.
That's right. Pop out for free. Well, that actually brings up one last point about moving around the board. Intercepting. As somebody who loves playing the tank in games, I love the intercept mechanic, which is basically if you are free and an opponent is trying to base with someone who is standing behind you, you can interrupt and charge in and basically base that opponent before he gets to your squishier allies. You can only do it once, obviously, without talents or feats, and you can only do it while you're free, again, without talents or feats. So if you like playing the tank, it's definitely something to keep in mind. It's also definitely something to keep in mind as a player. Stand behind the guys with the higher armor if you're playing a squishier class. Well, let's head into Class Act.
Class Act.
Welcome to Class Act, where we're talking about the Paladin today.
I smite thee.
That's right. If you are a person who enjoys following a cause, wearing heavy armor, and smiting all who stand oppose you, play the Paladin. One of the neat things about 13th Age Paladin is it's kind of gone the same way as 4th edition, where, and let's be honest, as most of us house ruled it back in the day, paladins are not restricted to just the lawful good alignment anymore, especially with talents like Mark will bring up, the Way of Evil Bastards. But Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Paladin?
He is the iconic plate-wearing warrior, with a cause, like you said. and when I ran D&D, my paladins were lawful good.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Now, how you interpret that lawful good.
Runs the gamut from lawful stupid gamut. To...
Oh, yes. I once saddled a paladin with a goblin who surrendered. Because, you know, hey, he surrendered. You can't kill him. You're lawful good. He never played a paladin again. So, like another episode, we talk about the barbarian. They are one of the simpler mechanics in the game. But there is a lot of thought when you look at talents and feats when you're creating a paladin, because you don't get a lot as you right. go up. So if you make the wrong choice when you start, later on when you want that really cool, epic feat, you can't get it because you have to have the adventurer and the champion. So you really got to think what kind of paladin you want to be. Do you want to be the tank-like, I'm going to deal a lot of damage? Do you want to be the warrior that can also do clerical spells? Mm-hmm. Or the healer, because you do have laying out of hands, and that can help other people. My personal paladin has not, well, he has a cleric domain for more damage for strength. Doesn't do the healing thing. Not that he's really out for himself. He just, the other party members are disposable. We're on a mission, and if you die, you know, I'll salute you, move on, great, but we're moving on. That's the cleric's job. So you have to think about what you want to do when you create... your cleric.
So from your mindset, do you think that the simpler mechanic classes require a little bit more forethought at the beginning during creation?
I think so. Okay. I think so. And I haven't tried to roll up a sorcerer, a wizard, or a bard who has a lot of choices. But I'll probably look at that and see. But I know looking at least the barbarian, because we have one in our group, and the paladin, and the talents, it's like, oh, that's great. Oh, that one's great too. You have... what looks like a short list, but you're very limited. You know, you start with your 3 feats, your talents, and they go up, but you don't get a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to decide, am I the damage dealer? Am I the healer type, quasi-healer? Which happened in a one-shot. We didn't have a cleric, and I had lay on hand, so I was able to help
right.
other characters because we didn't have a cleric. Or do you want to have some cleric spells? You can do that straight out. Just like when you create the ranger, which... I'm guessing we'll talk later
yes.
on another episode,
oh, yes.
and they have choices on how they want to do stuff mm-hmm. and some things. So,
yeah.
Just because it says simple, don't just throw it to the new guy and let him drown. There are some choices to make on what do you want to do.
Yes.
Well, one thing that I noticed in reading the core rulebook about that issue right there, about making sure you have good choices of as far as your talents and your features at the very beginning, is that the way that the book is written... they give you, the authors give you the freedom to change that up later on in the game.
Yes, if you have a good if you have a good GM and you're like, you know what, I picked this, it's not what I thought it would do, or by the 5th session, you know what, I've never used this talent.
Mm-hmm.
How
right.
about we change it?
Now,
if he's a good GM, he's like, sure, you know, that makes it your story, or you change. They talk about that. As you change, my paladin follows the crusader.
And one thing
maybe GM will make me switch to the great golden worm.
It might happen.
Never.
And one of the things they talk about is making sure you have a good story to go along with it.
Yes.
Not just, hey, I woke up the next day and I have all of these other features or all these other talents instead, but to immerse yourself in the story, figure out, well, why did you change from being fearless to being implacable?
Right.
You know, sort of deal.
Yes, yes. And that was one of the notes looking at doing this podcast was role versus role.
Yeah.
You know.
ROLE versus ROLL.
Yes. Yeah. You know, what kind of character? I talked about that
yeah.
earlier. What kind of character, even if I'm not the biggest, baddest guy in the battlefield, I wanted to play a paladin. And this
oh.
is.
And you are the biggest, baddest guy on the battlefield.
No, we got joined by that barbarian. He's pretty
that's,
bad.
That's true. I think it's just because he bats cleanup.
That's true. That's true. I do stagger his foes for him with smite.
Well, as Mark pointed out, the paladin has a lot of flexibility in what they can do. I mean, they wear heavy armor. They can be healers. They can be half clerics, if you will, with some talent choices.
Half orc, half cleric.
Half orc, half cleric. One third paladin. They're not one unique thing. Not very good at math.
That would be unique.
That would be unique. So, Nick, why don't you tell us about some of the choices you can make as a paladin?
Well, you start out by being able to pick three talents, and by the time you're done leveling up, you will gain an additional two, so you'll end up with five. A couple of the ones that stood out to me were Divine Domain, where you choose a domain, and where you choose one of the domains listed in the Cleric's class talent list, and you gain all of that domain's advantages, including the ability to use the domain's invocation once per day. So this is where we were talking earlier about being able to, your paladin has a lot of flexibility with it. Only, you know, if you want to change domains, you're able to do that. For that particular one, you can choose a second one once you get to level 5, and again at level 8 if you wanted to. The talent that stood out to me the most was the Paladin's Challenge, where when you're in combat, you are allowed to essentially issue a challenge to one of your opponents. And then once that challenge is issued, you and that opponent are locked into battle with each other. If either of you tries to attack someone else until the other one is bested, then there's a pretty heavy penalty to that disengage. I think it's a pretty cool talent, because it gives you a lot of, I think, story opportunities in combat to say, well, hey, I see this orc and I'm going to go launch myself at him, challenge him to attack. You know, when you watch the movies or read the books, there always seems to be this epic battle between the, I mean, let's go even back to David and Goliath. You got one hero from each side battling it out.
Yeah.
And this allows you to, in combat, be that hero, call out their biggest, baddest guy, but maybe saving the rest of your team, because if you challenge the head wizard, that wizard can't cast any spells at anyone else except for you, unless they're gonna, you know, try to disengage. And then later on, you would if you take the let's see here, if you level up and get the champion feat, you would are able to have two challenges active at the same time with different enemies. So by that time, you're gonna be pretty bad, and you're gonna be able to take on more than one opponent at a time.
Good point. Well, Mark, what's your favorite talent?
So my favorite talent is the Way of Evil Bastards. It's the way I play my paladin. I like it. It works with that because he follows an ambiguous icon.
Mm-hmm.
So not the lawful good shiny. He's kind of grayish, rusty armor. What I like about it, I took the adventure feat. It allows you to, once a day, reroll your relationship dice with ambiguous or villainous icons, and believe me, that comes in handy when you reroll sixes.
Yeah,
very helpful. Also helps when you are fighting. If you use your smite and you drop some mooks, you don't expend the smite, which is good because you are limited to how many you get to use during the day. And I just like it. Now it's opposite of that is the Path of Universal Righteous Endeavor if you're a goody two shoes type ballad.
Well, my favorite talent is the clerical training. I always see paladins as drawing on the power of the gods. So being able to cast a cleric spell of my level or lower and getting the feats to make that sing even more. There are some great cleric spells that are close spells so that you can cast them in melee combat while you've got your challenge up.
So why don't you just play cleric?
Because I'm the GM. No one else is.
Oh, okay.
No Talk of the Paladin would be complete without talking about Smite Evil.
And I, Mark, smite thee.
Seeing as you are the Paladin in our group, why don't you tell us a little bit about how Smite Evil works in 13th Age?
Well, so you have Smite Evil, which they also talk about. It could be Smite Good, Smite Enemy, depends on your take on the world. You declare when you're attacking an enemy if you're going to smite them, and if you hit, you do an extra D12 damage, which is pretty good. And if you take the Adventure Champion and Epic Feats, the Adventure gives you +4 to hit, which is good. Easier to hit the enemy and make it go off, because if you miss, it's still gone.
Right.
It's gone, but one of the good things about this Smite Evil is you still do half damage. So you get the added die.
Yeah, roll the
half,
whole
so you're
thing.
Doing more than just your level for your miss damage. And then it goes up to 2d12 and 4d12, and it does a lot more damage. You get one per battle, and then the rest are based on your charisma.
Nice.
So if you have a high charisma, good for paladin, again, in that build and what you're doing, not just strength and con, you can get more smites and it helps.
Well, how would you build a paladin? Well, what would your ideal paladin be here?
He'd be about 6'4", sandy brown hair.
enjoys warm oatmeal cookies and walks on the beach.
Yes. No, I put a lot of points in strength and charisma. After that would be con and dex. I like the way they average more than just one ability for your armor class and physical defense and mental defense. So all of them come into play. Mm-hmm. Strength is a good one because you want to deal damage, you know, and your charisma gives you that extra smites. So I put them in that way. Now, if you're talking about the whole paladins for race and everything.
Yeah, it's Kalam
Kalam, it's how I want to play him now. I've played human paladins. I played a half-ogre paladin.
Nice.
That was nice. Kalam is a half-orc paladin. He's a Hellhole commando, follows the Crusader. And his one unique thing is he has demon blood.
Oh.
And he has an conflicted relationship with the Diabolist. So he has some demon blood. We haven't really talked about, does he know or not know? I'm sure, because I'm a sucker, I threw it out there to jam, and I'm sure he'll twist that knife in my kidney later.
It's the way I roll.
So
it's going to get eaten by the great gold worm.
I'm sure I'll get turned at some point and, you know, kill the ranger or kill the sorcerer or somebody in the party and grow horns in the tail.
Oh, thanks for all of those ideas. Well, Nick, what about you? What's your? How would you build a paladin?
I think I'd go with the half-elf race, kind of down the recommended route, I should say. The background that I would take would be that I fought in the Abyss alongside the Great Gold Worm, and my one unique thing was that I was blessed by the Great Gold Worm.
Oh.
But I don't know what the blessing was.
Huh. Interesting.
So that, I think that would open the door for the GM to kind of step in and say, hey, you're going to get this boon because this is actually what your blessing was,
right.
Or, you know, be able to work that out with the GM.
Well, I'd have left you in the Abyss.
Yeah.
Mark is just as evil as I am, if not more. Well, for me, I like elven paladins. It goes back to second edition days. One of the DMs I played with allowed me to do it. And so I have this idea of this, you know, court-born background, very noble. My one unique thing is that the next time I meet the elf queen, she will die. Don't know why. Don't know what's going on. I've always looked up to her and cherished her. So kind of a Lancelot feel to the character. I'm sure Mark would also twist the knife in my kidneys with something like that. He's just shaking his head yes. So
I just can't believe the blasphemy that in second edition he let you play a non-human paladin.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.